Hello, and welcome to the Heavenbound Podcast. My name is Jason Harden. I'm here with Roger Shouse, and we are opening the Bible in search of fuel for your spiritual journey. This is where we talk about life the way it was meant to be and what it means to be a disciple of Jesus in the 21st century. We appreciate you joining us on the journey. On Fridays in the month of June, we are walking through some lessons from the seasons of David's life. You're actually tuning in to part two of a little four-part series. If you missed part one this past Friday, we looked at the first season of David's life as it's captured in Scripture. Roger, we called those the shepherding years, some powerful lessons that we can learn from that. But here in part two, we are turning to another season.
Yes, I guess if we were following the seasons of the year, this would be summertime.
Okay.
And we're going to be looking at the fugitive years of David. Now, when we hear the word fugitive, we often get the idea that someone's on the run, he's trying to flee the law. David was a fugitive, but he was innocent. And we see that the nation, King Saul, was against him. And throughout this midsection here of the book of 1 Samuel, where the story is told, we find David going from place to place. Saul, multiple times, we'll mention here in just a moment, tries to kill David. And there are lessons to be learned during the fugitive years. There's times in our lives when not so much we're running for our life, but things just don't seem to be working right. And things, it seems like everyone's against us, and it just seems like things are falling apart. And there's some lessons we can gather from this as we look at this. It seems like, from the context in 1 Samuel chapter 18, that what started all this was when David came home from killing Goliath. In 1 Samuel chapter 18, it says in verse 6, "It happened as they were coming when David returned from killing the Philistine, that the women came out from the cities of Israel singing and dancing to meet King Saul with tambourines, with joy and musical instruments." It's like the soldiers coming home. We've might have seen some films or pictures when World War II was over, and there's ticker tape parades running through New York City, and they were victorious. The next verse says, "The women sang as they played and said, David has slain his thousands, and Saul has slain his thousands, and David his 10,000s." And then the very next verse says, "Then Saul became very angry." David was just a young man, but now he's a national hero. And everyone loves heroes. He's young. He's good looking. He's defeated a giant that no one else could deal with. And they're singing songs. We can imagine today he'd be his face would be on the magazines. His face would be on the national news. There'd be a line of people wanting interviews from him. And all of a sudden, the man at the top, King Saul, is no longer at the top. People are more interested in David than they are the king. And this begins a long period of Saul hating David.
Yeah, I think it is so important that we appreciate the context of this, because it teaches us a really valuable lesson. Roger, I know that you have talked with others the way that I have, who live with the assumption, even in the 21st century, if I live for God, life is going to go well. If I am courageous and try to do the right thing, then my life will be easier than if I chose to dishonor God or do what I know to be wrong. We have many all around us, and perhaps it's easy for us ourselves to buy into the idea that if I'm good, life will be good. If I'm courageous, life will go the way that I want it to. And here is one of the classic examples in the Bible that show us, okay, a young man after God's own heart, willing to step up when no one else, including King Saul himself, is willing to step out in faith onto that battlefield against Goliath, and he does what is right. He invokes the name of God. He becomes a national hero and a great example that inspires many, many, many people. And what happens next? He has to start running for his life.
He does. So let's follow a flow here in 1 Samuel 18 that describes how Saul views David. You know, you would think that Saul would be first in line to congratulate him, the war hero, Medal of Honor, great accolades. But as we just read a while ago, verse 8 says, Saul became very angry. The very next verse, verse 9, Saul looked at David with suspicion. Down in verse 12 of the same chapter, now Saul was afraid of David. Verse 15, when Saul saw that he was prospering greatly, he dreaded David. And so we just see this downward spiral of Saul's attitude toward David. And then it comes to a point where he tries to get rid of David. If the national hero no longer is alive, all the attention will go back to me. And so starting here in chapter 18, there's a series of six attempts in the next two chapters where Saul tries to kill David. Verse 11, as David's playing the harp, Saul throws a spear at him, tries to kill him. In chapter 18 and verse 25, as David wants to marry Saul's daughter, he tells him to have this dowry. The dowry was to kill basically 100 Philistines. And David killed 200 Philistines. Chapter 19, here it talks about how Saul told his son Jonathan, all his servants, to put David to death. This is like a warrant for his death, we would say. In verse 10 of chapter 19, he again throws a spear, tries to pin David against the wall. In verse 14, he sent messengers to take David. Again, in verse 20, he sent other messengers to take David. So just within these first two chapters here of this little section here, we notice multiple times when Saul's jealousy, his anger, and his hatred just made him lose all control. We must remember that Saul is the king of Israel. He's supposed to be one of God's people. He's just thrown away so many of the Ten Commandments here. His emotions are running wild, and he's not even reasoning as a man of God through all these passages.
Yeah, and one of the things that really comes to my mind as I think through, okay, being in Saul's sandals versus David's sandals, they're both frustrated by different things, right? They both are dealing with disillusionment in this season of their lives. They are both afraid. Saul, you highlighted, he is jealous. The question is, how am I going to handle those things? And that really is a timeless question, because we also know what it is at times to be afraid or frustrated or disillusioned or to feel that green monster of jealousy rising up in our spirits. What are we going to do when we experience those things? I love the statement of David in 1 Samuel 24. We won't take the time to read the entire account. It's one of these times when David has a golden opportunity in the eye of his fellow soldiers to get even, or just to stop this terrible fugitive process altogether. Here is Saul right there. He doesn't even know that David is in the cave. David has every opportunity to kill Saul and just end it all together. But you listen to what David says in 1 Samuel 24 and verse 11 to the king. He says, "See, my father, see my hand against my Lord, for he is the Lord's anointed. The corner of your robe in my hand. For by the fact that I cut off the corner of your robe and did not kill you, you may know and see that there is no wrong or treason in my hands. I have not sinned against you, though you hunt my life to take it. May the Lord judge between me and you. May the Lord avenge me against you, but my hand shall not be against you. As the proverb of the ancients says, out of the wicked comes wickedness, but my hand shall not be against you." I want you to think about that ancient proverb. Out of the wicked comes wickedness. There are things that squeeze us, when fear squeezes us, or jealousy, or frustration, or disillusionment, and what squeezes us, there's something that's going to come out. If my heart is set on wickedness, wickedness is going to come out. If my heart belongs to God, something else is going to come out.
And Jesus said a similar thing in Matthew 12, where it talks about a good tree and a bad tree. A good tree is going to produce good fruit. A bad tree is going to produce bad fruit. That's the basis of our hearts. Let's for a moment now, Jason, let's be in the shoes of Saul.
Okay.
And again, you know, the story may seem to be out of touch with us, but it's not. Let's think, here's this, we've just gotten through graduation. Here's this young kid just graduated from college. He's hired where you work, and he's the sudden rock star. I mean, he's doing what no one else has done. He gets all the company praise. He's just flying high because he is just so gifted. Or here comes somebody, and they're better looking than you are. Or here comes somebody and they have more talent than you do. That idea of jealousy, that idea that here's somebody and they're better than I am. How do we deal with that?
Yeah. To me, the best way of thinking through it that helps me. Now, I at times lose sight of it, but what I try and remind myself of is, in what or in whom is my identity? If my identity rests on my performance, well, there's going to be ups and downs. And if there are ups and downs in my performance, just like everybody else, right? We have good days, bad days, whether we work in an office or a factory or we're a salesperson or we're preachers. We're going to have ups and downs. We're going to at times feel like we're just riding on the top of the world and the whole earth is our oyster. And there are going to be times that we're just frustrated because nothing seems to be going right. If my identity is in my performance, then boy, my sense of self-worth and my hope and my perspective, it's just going to be like riding on a roller coaster at Kings Island. I'm going to be miserable to be married to because my wife is never going to know which high or low she's going to be interacting with today. I'm going to be distant, perhaps from coworkers. I'm probably not going to be a good example, especially on my bad days. I'm going to kind of be like a pinball, right? That is just bouncing from thing to thing. Or if my identity is tied to, okay, where I rank in relation to all of the people around me, it's going to be awfully easy for me to look at others who are doing good work or doing even the Lord's work, look at them as rivals, not as co-workers, not as co-laborers, someone who can lift my hands up and I can lift up their hands and we're celebrating together the gains and the victories that the Lord is providing. No, you're a rival. We could just go on and on and on. If my identity is tied to how I look, well, looks are constantly changing. And for most of us, they're not improving as we age, right? But if my identity is tied to God, that is the key.
It is. And I think behind a lot of jealousy is pride.
Yeah.
And sometimes when we get real jealous of someone else, we kind of diminish the good they're doing. We kind of think evil of them. Here comes somebody with a new car in there, and first thing we think of is, well, you know, he got his money wrong, or he did this. You know, we try to put it down, and that's part of that pride within us dealing with those things. And the pride can make us go cross the line. That's what happened to King Saul here. He crossed the line. And it can make us do things so that it will build us up. If I can eliminate David, then everyone will go back to me. And I'll be the hero once again. And pride will cause us to do things like that. You know, it's interesting, and this is, you know, maybe a side point for all of us, but when we think about the women singing those songs, okay, they were saying that Saul killed thousands, but David killed his 10,000. They were just happy rejoicing that these heroes had come home. But sometimes that can feed jealousy. We can do that in the church sometimes. You know, I like this preacher better than that preacher. I've had people even say to me, you know, I like preacher so-and-so better than you. Well, okay. You know, I mean, I don't know what my response is supposed to be, but if you don't handle that right, it can start crossing that line and having evil thoughts. Yeah. And so how do we, as we still think about in the shoes of Saul, how do we keep our emotions from getting the best of us?
Yeah. There are several psalms that are tied specifically, we know, to this time in David's life. And I would just reference one. We could go to Psalm 52. We could go to Psalm 142 and others. Psalm 57, I think, answers the question, even though it's written by David, and the subscript tells us this is of David when he fled from Saul in the cave. But I think a few statements in this psalm answer your question about Saul. Let me just read a few verses. David says in Psalm 57, verse 1, "Be merciful to me, O God, be merciful to me, for in you my soul takes refuge. In the shadow of your wings I will take refuge till the storms of destruction pass by. I cry out to God Most High, to God who fulfills his purpose for me. He will send from heaven and save me. He will put to shame him who tramples on me. God will send out his steadfast love and his faithfulness. My soul is in the midst of lions. I lie down amid fiery beasts. The children of man, whose teeth are spears and arrows, whose tongues are sharp swords. Be exalted, O God, above the heavens, let your glory be over all the earth." He says in verse 7, "My heart is steadfast, O God. My heart is steadfast." I think what you're seeing in Saul is a heart that is not steadfast. That is the difference here, as far as I can tell. Saul's heart is tied up in jealousy and fear and frustration and disillusionment, and that is what leads to throwing a spear at David on more than one occasion. That is what leads to, you know, getting all sorts of mercenaries and worthless men who are willing to do such wicked things at the command of the king in trying to hunt David down. If you're going to get that untangled, if you're Saul, if you're going to get back on the right track, you've got to humble your heart and make it steadfast in the Lord.
And your faith has to be strong in the Lord. That's the key through all this. And, I mean, there's similar parallels in the New Testament we could look at, but they just didn't develop the way this developed. When we're talked about Apollos in the New Testament, he's described as mighty in the scriptures, an eloquent man. He was a powerful preacher. When we read about the Apostle Paul, the Corinthians complained about the way he preached. They didn't like the way he preached.
They found him unimpressive.
And so how easy could it have been that Paul would have kind of thrown, you know, at least emotional spears at Apollos, but he didn't do that. And one of the things you remember is that all of us have different talents. All of us are good at different things. God did not give any of us zero talent, zero ability. So maybe you're not gifted in one way. You can be gifted in another way. And Saul should have been thankful that David was on his side and not the Philistine side. And David was part of the nation, and David was helping the nation. For that, he should have been thankful for that. But instead, his emotions got the best of him and got his reasoning just where it shouldn't have been. Now, let's flip over now. Let's talk about David. Let's be in David's shoes now. And here's a young man, just doing what he's supposed to be doing. He's giving it his 100%, but now others around them are pointing fingers at him. They're jealous of him. They're trying to destroy his character, trying to destroy him. What does David learn about all this?
Yeah, well, I think much of it is rooted back in part one of this little series, those shepherding years, right? Where it was just David and the sheep in the Lord in the darkness on the hills. When power or popularity or prestige suddenly sneaks up on a person whose heart is not humble or steadfast in the Lord, if they're not deeply rooted in the Lord, that power can intoxicate them and lift them up and then crush them, right? We see example after example after example, even in the 21st century, of someone who immediately becomes known or powerful, someone who suddenly enjoys where we think great meaning and significance would be found, and it's the worst thing that could possibly happen to them. The reason David is able to endure the way that he is and even write beautiful psalms like Psalm 57 is, number one, his identity is rooted in the Lord, and number two, he believes even in those lowest of lows. He says, for instance, in Psalm 57, verse 10, your steadfast love is great to the heavens, your faithfulness to the clouds. And so even when it is difficult and inconvenient, to say the least, David is going to be faithful to a faithful God.
Multiple times in Psalms, he would refer to God as his refuge, his safety. And, you know, the difference between Saul and David is Saul was putting all the credit upon himself. David never took the credit off of God. When he was describing encountering the lion and the bear, it was God who helped him. When he's facing Goliath, it was God who will bring him down. You know, David was just the instrument. He never, ever forgot that it's not me. It's not my power. It's not that I'm so significant. It's God who's doing those things. And I think that's the key to that. I believe another lesson David learned in all this is he learned not to be like Saul.
Yeah.
And that is the major temptation to all of us. Someone is jealous of us. They start acting mean toward us. We start acting that way back toward them. And it's kind of like the ping pong game. You know, if you're nice to me, I'll be nice to you. But if you're kind of short with me, I'll be short with you. And if you're unkind, I'm going to be unkind. And so we just kind of play follow the leader, whoever the leader happens to be. But we do not see David doing that. We don't see David ever picking up a spear, throwing it at Saul. We don't see David thrice talking to Saul. He never did those things. Even though we may think he had every right to do that, he didn't do that. And so when someone's mean to us, we got to remember the golden rule. We have to remember how Jesus, as Peter described in 1 Peter 2, suffered, but he uttered no threats in return. That's our example, and that's what we have to be. And it's during those difficult times, I believe our light really shines, and it's during those difficult times that it really calls upon us to put our heart and our faith in the Lord.
Yeah, we heard David say, may the Lord judge between me and you. Ultimately, he is leaving this in the Lord's hands. And that is a New Testament concept as well. The way that Christians are instructed, for instance, in Romans 12, repay no one evil for evil. That was the temptation, right? But give thought to do what is honorable in the sight of all. If possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. Beloved, never avenge yourselves, but leave it to the wrath of God. This is in the Lord's hands. Even that is a step of great faith.
A season when David's on the run. You know, our seasons don't stay the same. He wasn't a shepherd all his life. He wasn't a fugitive all his life. There's different periods in his life, and through these different periods, he's being tried, he's being tested, and his faith is there. And so whether you're in your shepherd years now, maybe you may feel like you're a fugitive when you go into the workplace, or you remember walking down that hallway of high school. Maybe it just feels like all eyes were upon you. Everyone was whispering, and it wasn't kind things that they were saying. Remember these things, and remember to put your heart and your faith and your trust in the Lord. These will make the difference.
Very well said. Roger, thanks for joining me today. Thanks to all of you for listening to the Heaven Bound podcast. Lord willing, next Friday we'll take this a step further. Having talked about the shepherding years and the fugitive season, we'll talk about the royal season in David's life. But we hope this part two of the series has helped you set your mind on things above and given you a little more fuel for the journey. Always remember, when you're walking with Jesus, you are heaven bound, and the best is yet to come.